So this is...
Are you recording?
It's recording.
This is much more like a pilot of a TV series than the first inning of a baseball game. The first inning of a baseball game, you have no idea what's going to happen the rest of the game. Whereas in a pilot, you meet all the characters. And there's always something really interesting that happens that you don't realize is significant until you actually look back at the pilot afterwards. So, this module is... Well, my original title for this was Confusion in the Three Yanas, and Emily wouldn't want that at all. So it's Wisdom in the Three Yanas. But it turns out to be the same thing. And you have to wait until June to find out exactly how that's going to be. The first part is an examination of Trungpa Rinpoche, some chapters of Trungpa Rinpoche's Myth of Freedom, or supplemented by some chapters in Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism that I sent to you. I hope you got it. Sent PDFs of those chapters. And what's interesting and exciting for us teachers is that these are very much the works that we went over and over again as we were aspiring students of Trungpa Rinpoche back in the early 80s. In fact, Emily and I took a course on Myth of Freedom together.
We did?
We did. He used to give me a ride home. We both lived in Somerville.
Oh, I forgot. Don't remember.
Do you remember you had a red car?
What?
You had a red car.
I had a red car.
I think
car.
A Toyota.
It was Emily.
It was Emily. It wasn't you. I didn't meet you till a few years. So.
Thank you.
So, and then what? So, what these works by Trungpa Rinpoche do? Is we're going to first set the table, and tonight we're going to talk about the whole mess of our relationship with our emotions and how meditation practice and the path tends to work on that and what the outcome can be. So that's tonight, and we're going to go through very methodically. We'll talk about, Erica will lead a discussion of negativity next week. Something I'm sure she can do very well. She's got it. And then on my left, Michael does love. And further to my left, Michael does the open way in Mahayana. At which point we're going to catapult into Vajrayana. When Emily returns, she'll do a guided meditation. Then we'll work on a couple classes on Tantra. And then we were wondering what to do after that. And I had a brainstorm, and Emily thought it was a great idea. We're going to go through Penetrating Wisdom by Punwak Rinpoche. And some of you might remember doing the Aspiration of Samantabhadra last winter. Well, this is a commentary on the Aspiration of Samantabhadra. So we're going to go through how it is that confusion is wisdom. Not transformed, not because comes, not changed into, but confusion is wisdom. How are we going to pull that off? Well, first of all, there's no we, and there's no pulling it off. But we'll have to get there. So, did people have a chance to look at the reading for tonight? If you didn't, a few emotions are fine. Have people much familiarity with reading Trungpa Rinpoche? Oh. Those of you for whom this is the first time, what are your impressions? What do you think? What's your sense of it? Is it similar? Is it different from what you've encountered before? I'm curious.
The question about first time, is it something?
First time. First time or is fairly recent. Are you It's not like somebody you really care very much about.
In this group, we've read quite a bit of this.
Yeah. Have you?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
But I will say, because we veered and did a whole bunch of other stuff quite recently, and then coming back to this, it felt very grounded. For me.
Grounded in meaning you felt like more clear on the material?
Yeah.
Okay. So...
He has a sense of humor.
Mm-hmm. What's that?
He has a sense of humor.
He does. Mm-hmm. He can be very funny.
And I like his choice of words.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He's wonderful with language. He's wonderful with imagery. I'm just calling us stinking blue cheese. That's beautiful.
I was going to say, his metaphors are phenomenal. They're great for just creating a different style of understanding of what he's talking about.
Yeah, many Buddhist teachers sound like theologians. Mm-hmm. He sounds like a poet.
Yeah.
Which he was.
And I think his use of language is something that is very striking about him. And it helps a lot of people sort of get it before they even have a real abstract sense of what they're getting. It's very penetrating, I find. So, we're going to talk about working with emotions. I don't even want to say working. Being with the emotions in terms of view, in terms of what's called ground, which is like what is our current situation, especially as meditators, what the path looks like, and what the outcome looks like, what the fruition looks like. And so what I've done is I've taken a few concepts from both the dualistic barrier and the lion's roar. So the view is how he begins the lion's roar, that every state of mind is workable, without exception. That, and he evokes the sculptures of the Ashokan period in India, and the lions facing in four directions, meaning that there are no blind spots. They see everything equally in all directions. And that's kind of our path of meditation. As you know, you can fool yourself verbally. You can fool other people really easily, but when you're sitting for an hour by yourself and no one to talk to except in your own mind is just fluttering away, it's really hard to avoid what's happening. And this is sometimes like terrible, especially when we first get started. It's like, oh, my mind is a mess. Meditation must be causing this because I didn't know I was so crazy before. We also know that we have no choice but to be with whatever arises. Now, there's one caveat, though, and this comes up when we talk about emotions and meditation. We also need to know when to cut. Especially for those of us who have, let's say, addictive patterns. And, you know, and your thinking begins to go in a certain direction, and all of a sudden you feel sort of energized, and you know, there's sort of a burning feeling that happens when an addiction kind of faces you. And when I think we know ourselves enough, and we know our own private hell enough. So we, you know, it's very good to be vigilant, to sort of see things as they're coming. And if they're part of our craziness, to, you know what to do with that. And sometimes we need to be sharp and refocus. Nonetheless, that's pretty individual. Different people have different styles and different demons, we could call it. However, everyone else, or all of us, have pretty much the same array of emotional processes. We have approach avoidance, passion aggression. We also know that these are labels, that there are a lot of different gradient. There's a gradient of all of these. We also feel jealousy. We feel envy. We have puffed up pride. We have shame. We have insecurity, anxiety. Have I missed someone? Have I missed something? So, on one point of view, from one point of view, it sounds like we're all crazy, because we all have these kinds of places that our minds can go. We also know, and we find out eventually, if we haven't figured it out first, that we're all alike in a lot of ways. We may have different styles of articulating and approaching and all that stuff, but basically we're all in the same soup and we're dealing with a lot of the same problems, even with different circumstances. So now we get into the ground. And the ground is where we start from. And here, the important thing in Trungpa Rinpoche's presentation, he's talking about meditators and meditation. So he's not talking about mental health. He's not talking about what you do when your boss says something insulting to you and you really want to, you know, throw something at him or her. You know, we got that covered already. You know, we know we're not going to get fired in our job because we don't want to do stupid things. So we're talking as meditators, as people who have decided not to avoid ourselves anymore. So how do we relate to these? Well, in many cases, we find them really, really irritating, really difficult. Even when we're doing this sort of fantasy thing, and we're sort of puffing ourselves up, that's irritating, especially as meditators. So what's the problem? Why is it irritating? Anyone? Unless you really enjoy...
It shouldn't be there.
Shouldn't be there. Why not?
Should be nice and
because we're meditators.
Because we're gold star for her. Excellent. What's the problem?
We're all the same, as you said, right?
We're all the same. Therefore, as meditators, we're special. We don't have to go through what those ordinary people have to go through. And there's a phrase for that Trungpa Rinpoche uses called spiritual materialism. Sometimes it's called spiritual bypass. We think that if we're on some kind of a spiritual journey, we can kind of, you know, hop over the stuff that's difficult about us. The problem is often, and this is all of us, even the two Michaels over here who are very experienced, very processed. all of us have some kind of image of ourselves. And we may have especially if we've been practicing, well, we have sort of idealized image of ourselves. I've been practicing for 35 years and I'm really processed. And we find ourselves going through some kind of emotional upheaval and we feel insulted. It's like, why am I so damn primitive? Other people are like this, but not me. So that's one way, which is really irritating. It violates this sort of artificial identity that we tend to build for ourselves as meditators. You meditate long enough, eventually that you sort of develop a little bit of, I want those socks. After a while, we sort of begin to have a sense of humor about it. We begin to have a little perspective, but we can't forget, or we can't minimize the fact that sometimes we'll find our emotions, especially stuff like pride and envy. It's like, who wants that? They're so damn, it's such an ego stuff, and I don't want to do this, and here it is. So, how else is our emotions irritating to us?
They stir up a lot of stuff like ideas and memories.
And then you start
thinking of all the things. Like I was doing some anger last week, and it was like all the stories that go with it that don't matter until you sit there going, and then they did this to me, and they did that to me. I should be even angrier at them.
Of course.
And then
yes.
You're like,
yes.
I don't want to remember all that crap. There it is. Uh-huh. I didn't remember that until, yeah, I did.
You did? Uh-huh. Then what follows are usually like fantasies of retribution or revenge.
Oh. Plans, not fantasies.
All right. Precisely.
I think they're irritating because they're out of because we don't control them.
Exactly.
We don't control the emotions. They just show up.
They show up and they have a life of their own, and we can't just put them back in the bottle. Yeah.
And they're all filled with the want and don't want.
Oh, which is so painful. You know, we're like 2 year old or 2 years old again. I want this, I don't want this, I'm really angry. It's like, you know, those of you who have kids, you watch your kids do a temper tantrum, you realize you're like the same person.
Yeah, you don't need to have kids.
That's all right.
Any partner whatsoever.
Any partner. And she has a kid and a partner, so she should know. Okay.
Very old kid.
That's just your own mind. You got a kid right there.
So we experience emotions as problematic on account of these factors. They insult us, they can overwhelm us, they have a life of their own, we have to drop the illusion that we're controlling our own minds. And, you know, we want to control our own minds, and that doesn't work. And this sounds like terrible news, but it's actually great news. Because I don't want my mind to control anything. That keeps me narrow, and that keeps me very one-sided. It's much better to be open to a larger world. So, as you know, there are two strategies we tend to develop toward this problem of our emotions, and we know what they are, and we know they don't work. We know that indulging in them and acting them out and sort of using them as an identity, which sort of doesn't work because they're temporary, yet we tend to, you know, use them as an identity. It doesn't make us feel any better. We try to get relief by acting them out. And we just stir a bunch of karma, basically. And then, especially if you're just
I'm just wondering, where does the emotion like joy come into what you're talking about?
Oh, good question. Anyone. Joy. We all experience joy.
Well, that's spontaneous too. That's something you can't control as well. I think it's a trick when you want more of it and you don't want it to leave. Mm-hmm. It's the grasping thing that happens.
Yes. It comes with grasping.
Also, joy can make you feel deeply vulnerable. Really, you know, big joy.
Mm.
It's totally open up levels of vulnerability for you. And just some people, that's a dangerous territory for them to go into.
But not in the second you're feeling it. Like when you're feeling it, it's just there, like any other feeling.
But it can also quickly transform to fear. So you get that. I hear that a lot with parents. You know, they get a moment of absolute joy looking at their baby, and the very next thought is, "Oh my God, what if something happens to the child?" You know, so it goes right from huge fear to, or huge joy to, ultimate terror because they're afraid. They're afraid for this helpless child.
Think if you've ever had fantasies about like winning the lottery. At first, that kind of joy happens, then it's like, oh, what am I going to do with $184 million? Oh, my God.
I don't have to worry.
I hope you win the lottery and find out. See, another irritating thing about emotions, and this is going to be part of the path, is when we're there, when we're feeling them, there's a part of mind that doesn't do time. That when we feel joy, when we feel sad, when we feel lustful, when we feel angry, it doesn't have an end point.
No.
That moment, it doesn't have an end point. And it goes. But then it comes back. And it's very unsettling when you sit with that and you see that your mind is not one thing, it's actually quite rocky. And it's very discontinuous. And we tend to hold on to things like joy, pride. We can try to extend something into a fantasy, a romantic fantasy, or fantasy of revenge. We can sort of see ourselves doing that. So I eventually have to say, okay, give it up. But it takes a while to get there, and it's actually painful when we realize that we've been sort of conning ourselves. So we have a lot to work with. It's sort of wonderful. And we're all alike, and we all do the same, we all have the same tricks. I know there are some variations, and people can talk about gender behaviors and stuff like that, but basically they're variations on some common themes. And we have made the decision, many of us have made the decision because it's so hard to control our emotions, that maybe if we sit and meditate and we'll calm down and we'll be okay and these things won't bother me anymore. That illusion lasts a few minutes, a little while maybe. I think when we first sit, we're so caught up in the idea of, I'm meditating, that we don't sort of notice what's happening. Then things get a little dull. Then we can begin to sort of assess what's going on. But we soon find out that we really cannot hide from ourselves. And that becomes a great treasure because we put ourselves in a situation we can't hide from ourselves. And we find out that we have the ability, that our emotional life, all that stuff in us has tremendous amounts of insight, has tremendous amounts of energy, has a tremendous amount of connectedness with our world. So we practice with it. What happens? And the Trungpa Rinpoche gives a threefold process. The first thing is we begin to see its transparency. It's true, we can only think one thought at a time. And that thought is quick. And that thought goes very quickly. So what happens when's the last time you've been sitting and you've had sort of a stirring emotion? Have you ever sort of examined what that process is of that emotion? I found that I don't have anger, I have a multitude of thoughts which have a common connection of being angry, but they're sort of like beads on a mala. They're not continuous. There's gaps in there. So something surges, it goes away. Something else happens, and the same thing surges again. It goes away. And anger is really easy to talk about. Passion is much easier to think about than to talk about. But it works the same way. You know, you're feeling stirred up by somebody, and all this stuff wells up, and then it goes away. It goes up again and again. You think the entire meditation section has been doing nothing but thinking about some individual. And you realize at some point that, no, it's just over and over and over and over and over. There are lots of gaps and a lot of other things going on. That's the first hint of freedom. Because we realize it's not one solid thing. Trungpa Rinpoche talks about the skandhas here. He talks about the fifth skandha, being consciousness. It's like, what is actually happening on your mind moment to moment? What's the object of its awareness moment to moment? And we find out that if we just let consciousness be itself, we can see things come and go, come and go, come and go, come and go. What's the problem? We're also not adding to it. However, we also have the fourth skandha, which is called concept. And that appears in a lot of different ways. That's when we say, oh, I'm angry. And I think we have modulations, we have variations. We do not have the same two angry thoughts. So in some way, we can't have the same anger. It changes. And we just don't know. We just say, oh, I'm just being angry. Or I'm being irritated. Or I'm being passionate. Or I'm, you know, whatever. And we put labels on our experience and we actually miss the experience. We find out that one of the attributes that our mind has is called all labeling. We're continually trying to put our mind into these nice little categories. And our mind is too... Our mind pops out of them all the time. So, one of the first things that any of us can do, especially when our emotional life is on the cushion, especially, is rampant, is pay attention. Add some awareness to the thoughts as they come and go and multiply and are actually discontinuous. And the stories we begin to tell ourselves about what we're feeling and how we're trying to weave everything into an autobiography. Or we're rehearsing what was the phrase that Trungpa Rinpoche uses? We're like rehearsing a history of resentment or something like that.
Trying to get it all organized.
So let me stop here and see what people want to say.
I got a question. It seems to me that when you have those thoughts, sometimes you can't get out of the train. So. And also, for me, a lot of times I don't have the composure to analyze. You know, I'm just taken up by the emotion.
Right. And, okay, yes, somebody want to respond to what Harry's saying? Because I think that's all of our experience.
Absolutely.
Well, anytime any one of us loses our temper, that's what's happening. So you're not experiencing anything that everyone in this room doesn't experience. it's always 20/20 hindsight. I look back and go, oh, that's what I did.
Yeah, so in the middle of it, I don't see the discontinuity.
Right. You don't see the discontinuity in the middle of it. How long, however, are you in the middle of it?
Until the gong rings.
Until the gong rings. I love that.
Harry, I've had those times. Miriam.
My experience with anger, deal with a lot, and I work in a hospital setting, I work in cardiology, there's a lot of very intense emotion all the time with everybody, it's constant. My experience with anger, that it for me, it might get triggered by some misunderstanding or miscommunication or just some petty habit that we all in our department have, we all have our stuff. And something will trigger it externally. And then the mechanism inside sort of builds and builds, as you were saying. And I find it demands some sort of voice. It demands some sort of resolution, or it might be a conversation. It might be. And once it has that voice or it has that kind of resolution, you feel it also dying down. It could happen, in our case, it often happens over 2 or 3 days. It might be somebody who came in very sick. There was a family member that got angry. All kinds of things can happen. And so oftentimes it builds, and then it demands attention, I find. And one can look for the pauses and create a gap when it's building, but when it's in that building phase, it's pretty darn tough.
Sure.
It's usually
because you have an entire environment. You have an entire environmental situation to sort of reinforce it and build on
it. You do. Anger really demands voice and ego sometimes, and once it kind of hits that point where it's had its voice, I find that it becomes easier to engage the mind, engage constructive language, engage because we're working in the hospital with other people. We're always with a team, and so we're always working with the complexity
so
of
it's
the
almost
team
like a...
and other people's mindset and their emotions, and the patient's family members come in, they scream at you, the doctor comes in, they scream at you, and you're just like, woo!
Easy to laugh and smile here.
One can try to create these pauses, these gaps, but I find when it's building, it kind of has this beginning, middle, end. It's like a breath, and then finally the resolution and the exhale, and...
Okay.
That voice, that conversation, that negotiation, that it doesn't work too well to...
Someone?
Please. Well, I'm thinking, my thought when you said that was sometimes there is no voice. I mean, by myself, there's no voice. There's just, it's there, and it's... Mm. You know, all consuming, and to let it go instead of to ruminate for 20 minutes, you know, is really hard. In life, you can try to work things out and have a voice, but if you're just by yourself.
That's right. That's right. And that's the difference. When you're in the situation carries its own energy, and sometimes it's like a flood that needs to crest, and then the water can go down a little bit. And situations can be like that. However, if it's unable to... Okay, all right, I'll leave... Yes, Michael.
I experience the confusion settling down into ignorance, and that is, which you haven't really talked about, and that is a hard thing to work with.
Do you mean dullness?
Ignorance.
Can you say more about that?
Yeah.
I don't know what is happening, and I don't know how to handle my ignorance. My not knowing what is going on.
It's So a general
in
sense
of my path.
So it sends a like blurry confusion, like being overwhelmed.
It's blurry confusion, but it's not emotionally overwhelming. Okay. It's just a dull one.
Because sometimes we use that as a means to neutralize. We have to. Yes.
I find that sometimes anger is a mask for grief and fear.
Right.
So a lot of it, and it's that fear of not being heard. That's the fear of being taken over by all that imaginary being taken over. And I also find in this culture, grief is really, is actually the scariest thing for people to experience in the human experience. And so anger is easy.
Anger can be efficient. Grief
all
is
vulnerability. Yeah. Really unsafe.
Very well. Very good. That's right. Yeah. In our day, I mean, our society,
is
very confused on emotions. So we are in a society. So we are going to reflect that confusion. On the cushion, we have an opportunity to work things, work around things, work with things on our own, which is actually quite liberating. We can sort of do it ourselves. And so it may turn out that, you know, you go for a session, or especially like a group retreat. We have lots of time and people around you to irritate you and stuff like that. And so you may find that the irritation, the anger, the annoyance, you sort of are with that, and that sort of pops up, and then like a minor theme pops up along with the major theme. The minor theme might be some kind of insecurity or fear or grief, and that becomes part of the soup. And so you can, you know, you can see the broccoli at the bottom, or no, broccoli floats. You can see the beans at the bottom along with the broccoli at the top. Please stop me before I say anything.
I would add to that grief, our fear, the society's fear of grief, is largely why we're such a death phobic culture. Yeah. Incredibly death phobic, speaking of someone in hospice. Mm-hmm. So, also, our society sets an example in where our constant barrage of media that anger gets attention.
Oh, yeah.
And anger is much more socially acceptable, especially in media, than grief. Because we immediately want to distance ourselves. And this is the message that's sent over and over again. Distance yourself from grief. Pay attention to anger.
Yeah. Also, grief is a withdrawal. It's a diminution of energy and efficiency. Right. And so we're not 100%.
What do we do with that?
Oh, no! How terrible!
It can just be hurt. The anger can just come from hurt.
Most of the time.
Yeah, it just hurt. Mm-hmm.
There can be a lot of tenderness, a lot of weepiness, disguise, especially for men, and some kind of like, you know, posture of annoyance. Please.
I find a lot of times it's anger is an illusion.
How so?
Your mind just runs with a theme that's not even a reality.
Yeah.
You know, like you're just building up the situation in your own mind that's not even really happening.
I suspect this is not unique to you.
Right.
the current, and I'm not sure, hypothesis in psychology is that anger is a secondary emotion, but it's not primary. But it's that the primary is feeling hurt, abandoned, sad, joyful. Well, but you know that it's not a cover up, but it's what we go to second, and it's not helpful. But for whatever reason, it's like a defense against the other feelings.
As biological beings, we are protective by nature.
Right.
So, There are further steps here. The first step is seeing the transparency, or, I think you said it beautifully, we find out how powerful mind is. That it is capable of totally conning us into some version of reality that just ain't there. And we're so hooked by it. Mm-hmm. So the first thing we do is we start to dismantle that a little bit. It's not like, you know, all of a sudden you figure it out. It's like, you know, take some time and practice, and maybe if you have really good karma, it's easier for you than for other people like me, who have to sort of plug away for a long time. And so you sort of dismantle that sense of solidity or reality. You begin to appreciate that, you know, these things well up and they're vivid and they're powerful and they fall away. And, you know, it has this luminous side, but it also has a sort of transparent side. And we can begin to play with that a little bit instead of taking it so deadly seriously. And that's dangerous for our ego. Because once we start playing with it, we begin to realize that a lot of the stuff that fuels it is sort of relational to this. And we begin to wonder, who is feeling this pain? Who is feeling this horniness? Who is... And we start to dismantle central headquarters. Because part of the problem with emotions is it violates our sense of control, our sense of, I am a mature, special, spiritually evolved person. You know, all this sort of ego stuff. And we begin to say, well, maybe the problem is not the emotion, it's this thing we're creating. There we go.
Well, I'm just questioning something, which is there's a lot of energy in emotions, and mm-hmm. I think it can actually do the opposite. It can give you, as you were saying, a false sense of I am.
It can give you a false sense of I am, and it can also dissolve that false sense of I am. The energy itself.
The energy itself. Explain.
The energy itself.
Well, he talks about the energy and the pigment, and making this color, and making this dense color.
Yeah.
And then the pigment is the dualism, and you get rid of that, and it's just the transparent.
Precisely.
Color. It was beautiful.
It is beautiful. Go. Can you elaborate a little bit?
No.
Okay. All right. Can someone else elaborate? Was anyone else struck by that?
Well, it's sort of a rainbow.
Yeah.
And pigment has got, you know, solidity, and you can't see through it.
Uh-huh.
And so that's the non-freedom.
Yeah. And so what you find is that emotions have a certain directionality, dualist, you know, I'm envious of so-and-so because there's a reference point.
Right.
There's sort of a thing that we do. Okay? Hi.
Was that good company?
No, you need to go in the other door.
Thank you.
Okay. and also, we've all felt this on the cushion. All of a sudden, go like this. We get jazzed up. There's an emotional... There's an upheaval that goes with it. This is not a cognitive thing. Emotions are physical. They're physical not only in terms of our sort of gross physiological system, a lot of them, but also you can look at subtle body, look at all the ways in which people have conceptualized how our emotions create certain blockages and open certain floodgates in terms of subtle body. We also can think of it almost in terms of psychic energy, like Freud did. And that there's certain kind of rhythms that these have. And they are not something that our mind can put into a little box. So there's energy, there's emotion, there's duality, there's story, there's a sort of a transitory, and there's also a dreamlike character that they have. Wow, that's a lot of stuff to do.
Can you say more about dreamlike?
Well, in the sense that, as you were saying, how in a dream we're convinced that, you know, we're being chased by a wild boar down the aisles at Market Basket, and we're afraid that we're going to run into the eggs. And and it's real, and we can see those eggs cracking around us, and we wake up and we say, what a stupid dream I just had. And emotions can be, our emotional life can have that quality too. We've all gone through this. Passion is a particularly good one at this. Because all of a sudden we cooked up some kind of Harlequin romance or something much steamier. And we're so moved and so touched. And we realize it was like nothing. That's the dreamlike quality, which is vivid, but it's also empty. And we begin to realize that the rest of our experience can be like that too. But emotions give us a really sharp way of accessing it. So, next time, Harry, you're like this on the cushion, and you just can't get it out, you have a lot to do. There's not only the discontinuity, but simply the energy without having to refer to central headquarters. It's not about whether you're a good person or a smart person. It's just what it happens to be. And we can ride that energy, and that becomes, that mobilizes us. It can become creative.
Riding that energy is a really interesting phrase.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's like this is an old metaphor. It's like you're not riding a wild boar.
In the Market Basket.
What's that?
At the Market Basket.
Especially at Market Basket. But instead, there's a fluidity. There's a synchronization between you and the horse. Or you're simply riding the bicycle. Although bicycles, you have too much control over. So riding a horse walking the dog. Those of us who have walked dogs. Don't dislocate your shoulder. Please.
Pema Chodron had a really good talk about this. I don't remember which talk it was. And I think she was quoting Shugan Trungpa Rinpoche when she said that emotions are nothing more than thoughts with a whole lot of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And she talked about how you just want to try to create a little gap between the thoughts, the story,
mm-hmm.
and that energy, and kind of let that energy be its solid thing, its solid, alive thing, and then just with some attention, but without the story, it'll begin to perforate
mm-hmm.
and just kind of become a little less solid.
Mm-hmm.
And it may not go away, but it just won't be so solid.
The problem is we want it to go away.
Yes.
Then, of course, it's like music that's stuck in your head.
I find the breath is very helpful.
The breath.
Mm-hmm. Especially the exhalation helps to melt things.
Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And notice how your breath modulates when you're having an emotional response to something.
Yeah, I was just going to say that we maybe have a tendency to look at anger as something that is negative or takes over, but I like to actually excise it, put it there, and have dialogue. Say, what would you have me learn? What are you trying to tell me? Is there something about this situation I'm not seeing? And actually dialogue with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I have found that anger, when I'm able to do this, is pointing out to me specific places where I could be more articulate. I could have a voice. I could. So the part, sometimes the anger is teaching me something that I could be doing that might be more effective.
that might be constructive. So it doesn't have to be this thing that engulfs or overwhelms, but it could actually instruct about maybe a way in which I could...
You are just a few minutes ahead of me. Because I want to talk about fruition, okay? And that's very much a fruitional kind of thing. If it's, you know, done well. But there's another part of sort of disempowering central headquarters. And one half of it is you begin to see that... That you can do without all that self-referentiality. That the self that we're referring to is actually pretty, is just as insubstantial as these thoughts that seem to capture us. But the other part, and Michael Fagan will talk about that in a few weeks, we have to talk about sort of how it opens us up. Especially it opens us up to others and others, what others go through. And the liberation we all feel when we realize that we are not only not alone, but everybody is doing the same thing we are, and we're all miserable. And, you know, we decide that we'd like to do something about that. Because we have an enormous amount of potential, but you see how we get in our own way. We see how other people make themselves so unhappy. And so part of loosening up that self-referentiality is we actually open it up to include a broader range. And so it's harder for people to piss us off as much. We just see how they're doing it. We know it so well because we do the same damn thing, and we stop. You know, we stop feeling ourselves so special. And in fact, at the end, we decide that other people are much more interesting than we are. And so that brings us to, we've cut through some of the solidity. We've cut through some of the self-solidity. And so what are we left with? As you said, we're left with energy. We're left with, as Miriam was closing in on, the fact that these, what we call emotions or what we call problems, are actually pieces of wisdom. Now, how to get from here to there is called the path. But you'll find that in the Buddhist teachings, there's the mandala of, we'll call it enlightened wisdom, or the Buddha family mandalas. And so when we talk about anger, we talk about mirror-like wisdom. That anger, left on its own, without central headquarters operating it, becomes that kind of clear insightfulness. That pride becomes a sense of wealth and is called a wisdom of equality. Passion becomes discriminating wisdom. Meaning, we notice the differences and they are additive, they're not exclusive. I can like Janet's boots a lot or Susan's socks a lot, but I can also like other people's boots and socks too. They're just different. Our tendency toward envy and competitiveness becomes what's called all-accomplishing wisdom. And that part of us which numbs out becomes all-pervasive wisdom, which is actually the foundation. But we have to get there. And we'll be talking about that more. We get to penetrating wisdom. And we get to Tantra in general next month. So, the main point here at 8:58 is that beginning now, instead of thinking of ourselves as such a problem, that we are actually enormously wealthy, We all have winning Powerball tickets in our handbags or wallets. We just haven't found them. That we have not only the same display of display of energy as others, but we also have the same display of wisdom as others. That, yes, we solidify. We think things are real when they're not real. We measure things according to some kind of idealized standard. And we see that, and we work with that. That we begin to sort of sand that down over time. And so what emerges is a sense of innate wisdom and goodness. So this is a lot of good reasons to just get on the cushion and stay there. Because you're not going to get there any other way. Unless you have really good karma and you found a wonderful teacher and you don't have to meditate at all. The rest of us, we got to put a little time in. So, next week, we're going to work with negativity. And we're going to look at the protector principle and what are called the four karmas. And we're going to look at the basic sanity of negativity and the insanity of what we do with that. Mm-hmm. And Erica will lead a fine discussion, I am sure.
Well, thank you.
Let's see. That's about all I have to say.